done in collaboration with Kyriakos Papadimos, and which is based on this paper, and also about some work in progress. So I'll try and describe these two things. Since this is a mixed audience, I prepared a little bit of an introduction to the information paradox. You already heard an excellent review. But let me just remind you, since some of you work on different things, that the information paradox, very naively speaking, is a question that, you know, the matter that collapses to form a black hole contains a lot of information, but the Hawking radiation that comes out is something that depends only on the temperature of the black hole. And you can make this rather precise quantitatively, that it depends only on the temperature and doesn't know about the initial conditions that led to the formation of the black hole. And so the question is, where is the information after the black hole has evaporated? Where is all the information that lived in the initial state? Where is all this information gone? Okay. And this is a cartoon. It's a slightly cliched cartoon. But you know, if you were to take a library and throw it into a black hole, the black hole would become big after eating up the library. And then it could radiate via Hawking evaporation and go back to a small black hole. And then you're left with either the option, as was explained in the previous talk, that all the information in the library can live in an arbitrarily small black hole. You can throw in an arbitrarily big library in the beginning. Or, you know, that the information somehow comes out in Hawking evaporation. And for a long time, the standard belief was that somehow this information did come out in correlations in the Hawking radiation. That, you know, one could do, you would look at some string theoretic corrections, or you'd look at some quantum gravity corrections. And in some sense, they would modify Hawking's computation. And this information would come out in that. And that, you know, somehow when you do the correct version of Hawking's computation, all the information would come out. But for some time, Mathur, who really wanted to make the case that small corrections could not fix the Hawking computation, he sharpened the information paradox in 2009. And then this argument of Mathur was expanded upon by Polchinski and by AMPS, by the group that's now called AMPS. And it's this that has led to a lot of attention. But I think a lot more credit should be given to Mathur, who's really the one who made this original argument. And the claim, before I try and describe this AMPS argument briefly, is that, you know, in order to preserve unitarity, quantum gravity corrections have to be so large, okay, that they alter the structure of the horizon even for a big black hole. And this is something that violently contradicts our usual notions of effective field theory, where we believe that, you know, if you have a big black hole and there are small curvature scales, then near the horizon of the black hole, it looks like you're in empty space, and quantum gravity corrections are not very important. And so the claim here, the claim that was made first by Mathur and then by AMPS, was that, you know, to resolve the information paradox, you do need to modify the structure of the horizon. And let me just review the claim, which was already done in the previous talk. And the idea is to think of three subsystems. So you have this black hole here, and there's a lot of old radiation that was emitted a long time back that's gone far away from the black hole. And then you think of Hawking evaporation as being this pair creation process, where at every time step, you form a pair. You form a pair of particles and antiparticles. And one of them falls into the black hole, and the other falls out. And the one that falls out, I'll call B, and the one that falls in, I'll call C. Okay? And so the key point is to keep these three subsystems in mind. You know, let's say that the black hole is formed by the collapse of some pure state. Then you can look at the entropy of this radiation that's outside, the von Neumann entropy of this radiation that's outside. And very general arguments by Page, that were made by Page some time back, tell you that if you look at this entropy of this radiation, it starts off at zero. The reason it starts off at zero is because there's no radiation to begin with. And then it increases for a while. But then it has to start decreasing again till it ends back at zero at the final time of the black hole, when the black hole has completed its evaporation. And they're rather general arguments that make almost no assumptions that say that this is how this, the entropy of this radiation has to behave. And the key point is that it has to start increasing, but then eventually it must start decreasing. And the point at which this turnaround happens is called the Page time. Okay. So now consider an old black hole, which is beyond its Page time. So you're on the part of the curve where the entropy of SA is decreasing. And if this is true, then it must be true that, you know, after one time step, when this new Hawking quanta B goes and joins A, you've moved further along that Page curve. And so SAB, which is the entropy of A and B together, must be smaller than the entropy of SA, because you move down a little more along that curve, that downward sloping curve. But also, we know that since B and C, these two pairs, are related to the Bogoliubov transform of the vacuum, which is how you derive Hawking radiation, by taking what is the vacuum for the infalling observer and doing a Bogoliubov transform of that. So you know that B and C together are maximally entangled. But you also know that each of these bits individually, B and C both, are individually, they're thermal. So if you look at the bit B individually, it has some entropy, which is some order one entropy, because each of these bits that are falling in and out are thermal. But these three statements appear to be in contradiction, because there's a very general theorem, which is called the strong subadditivity of entropy, which tells you that if you look at, which tells you that SA plus SC for any three systems, A, B, and C, has to be smaller than SA, B, and SBC. And we are clearly in violation of that, because SAB is smaller than SA, and SBC is zero. And a colloquial way of saying this is to say that the system B can't be entangled both with A and with C. Okay, you have to have monogamy of entanglement, and that's one way this is expressed. But this quantitative relation tells you something more. It tells you that if you look at this, you see that this is violated not by some order epsilon amount, not by some order 1 over n amount, but it's violated by an order 1 amount. You see, because it's violated by the fact that SC, which is some order 1 number, is sitting here. And so it's violated by some order one amount. And so this is the argument that small corrections, if you try to make small corrections and try to fix, Hawking's computation using some string theoretic or some quantum gravity corrections, that this would not be able to fix this strong subadditivity of entropy argument. So this was the argument that AMPS made, and that Mathur and AMPS made, for why small corrections cannot restore unitarity to Hawking radiation, which was the belief before this. So what is the firewall proposal? The firewall proposal is the idea that we should drop this assumption that SBC is zero, at least after the page time. And once you drop this assumption, once you drop the assumption that you're in the vacuum of the infalling observer, then it's really hard to prevent the infalling observer from basically burning up. And so the claim is that you get a firewall. And it's very natural that the moment the fact that the infalling observer doesn't burn up as he crosses the horizon is because the radiation has a very specific form. If you try and play around with that form, generically the infalling observer will just burn up, and that's why you get a firewall. And so this is the picture. It's there's no computation that leads to this picture, but the argument is that you need to drop this assumption, and that naturally leads to the infalling observer burning up as he crosses the horizon. And you could have, in principle, something like this forming behind, just behind the horizon, so that the physics outside is not necessarily affected, but the subjective experience of an infalling observer is completely different. Instead of dying when he hits the singularity, he dies when he crosses the horizon. Okay, so that's the firewall proposal. And that's the claim that this must happen. And as I said, this completely violates our notions of effective field theory, because it says that quantum gravity corrections are important at a scale that is much larger than what we naively imagine. So in this talk, I want to try and test this proposal using the ADS-CFT correspondence, because it's one good way, it's perhaps the only good way we have of defining quantum gravity in some non-perturbative way. I'd like to break up this test of this firewall proposal. I should say, I should advertise at the beginning that in the end, I'm going to try and argue that this firewall proposal is not necessary, that you can preserve unitarity of Hawking radiation without having this kind of firewall proposal. But before I come to that, I'm going to argue that in several steps. And the first question one could ask is, you want to talk about the experience of the infalling observer. And the reason I stress the infalling observer, because it's the experience of the infalling observer that's modified in this firewall proposal. So it's the infalling, if you can describe the experience of the infalling observer using ADS-CFT, you would really have a sharp test of the firewall proposal. And that's why the infalling observer is so important in my talk. But the first question you need to answer is whether you can at all, describe the results of local experiments in ADS in terms of the boundary conformal field theory. And the answer to this is yes, but it wasn't, it's not always widely accepted that the answer to this is yes, and I'll try and describe that. And then the next question is whether you can use the conformal field theory to look beyond the black hole horizon. Does the conformal field theory know not only about what's happening in front of the horizon, but also about everything that's happening in the space-time, including what's happening behind the black hole horizon, and then whether you can use these answers to say something about the information paradox and about the firewall proposal. So that's a rough outline of my talk. So let me start with the first question about describing the results of local experiments. So I'm going to take a slight detour, and then I'll come back to the information paradox. Let me start with this first question. So, you know, the most generic feature of the ADS-CFT correspondence is that it has these objects called generalized free fields. Okay? So generalized free fields are operators which have the property that their correlation functions factorize. So you look at some endpoint correlation function of this generalized free field, and its correlation functions factorize up to some number, which is 1 by n, which is related to the central charge of the theory. Okay? But there's a difference. You know, this is something that happens also for perturbative fields. You know, if you look at perturbative fields in flat space, their correlation functions do factorize. But there's an important difference between these generalized free fields and between perturbative fields, and that is that these generalized free fields don't obey an equation of motion. Okay, their correlators factorize, so they're free in that sense, but they're generalized in that they don't obey an equation of motion. Okay? And for example, this O could be, you know, trace of F squared in n equal to 4 super Yang-Mills theory, but for the purpose of our discussion, it could be just about any scalar operator with some dimension delta. Okay? And the idea is that, these kinds of operators, you know, occur in almost all examples of the ADS-CFT correspondence we know, and the idea is that you can recast these operators in terms of a perturbative field in the bulk that does obey an equation of motion. Okay? And this is something that was discovered early on in the ADS-CFT correspondence by Banks and others. And the precise idea is that you take this operator O, which is a CFT operator, and you Fourier transform it, and you multiply it by certain mode functions, which are written down very explicitly if you'd like to see them. But they're not important for this discussion. But the fact is that they exist, and you get another operator. This is an operator in the conformal field theory, okay? Because this is just an integral transform of the conformal field theory operator with some functions, which I chose for whatever reason, and I get another conformal field theory operator. And this conformal field theory operator is parameterized by an additional number z. Okay, this is just a parameter in the CFT. But nevertheless, this CFT operator has the same properties as a free field living in anti-de Sitter space. And if you did this at interacting order, it would have the same properties as a perturbative field living in anti-de Sitter space. So for example, it obeys some commutation relations. If you take the, you know, commutation relations of O, very generally, if you take the two-point functions of O, you can show that this field defined by this integral transform obeys the canonical commutation relations that you would expect of a field living inside anti-de Sitter space. So this is a way to understand the emergence of anti-de Sitter space from a conformal field theory. You know, you take a conformal field theory, and the statement is that you can recast its dynamics. There's a natural way to recast the dynamics of these generalized free fields in terms of perturbative free fields, which look like they're propagating in anti-de Sitter space. And you can say this in position space, and Benna and Kabat and others have discussed this a lot. And you know, I can write this, rather than writing it in Fourier space, it's what I said earlier, I can write this field as an integral transform with some kernel which is appropriately chosen, but it is possible to choose this kernel so that this field behaves like a local field which obeys an equation of motion in some auxiliary spacetime. Okay? And the idea is that this construction, the belief is that this construction can be extended also to higher orders in 1 by n. Okay, so you can keep doing this perturbatively, order by order and 1 by n. And as I said, I think this is one of the clearest ways to understand the emergence of anti-de Sitter space from the conformal field theory. Yes? Well, I think it does exist. I disagree with that. I can try and describe to you later. I know there are some claims in the literature that it doesn't exist, but I think it does, as I will describe. Let me describe to you in a minute why I think it does exist. Okay. So now let's say you consider some CFT in a pure state, which is very, very close to being in, you know. So let's say you take the conformal field theory and you put it in some pure state, and so at a pure state which looks close to being in a thermal state. So we know that, you know, if you can take systems in pure states, and if you measure the right kind of observables, these pure states look like they're thermal for all effective purposes. Okay? And we would like to consider a conformal field theory in a pure state of this kind, because we don't want to couple the CFT to something else. So you want to prepare the CFT in some initial state that collapses to form a black hole, but the CFT is still in a pure state because it started in a pure state. Okay? And these same generalized free fields O have very different correlation functions on this state psi, and you can still construct perturbative fields in the bulk by writing down a different kind of integral transform of these fields. Okay, so to answer your question, since there's a Ben, So there were some claims in the literature that when you have these closed orbits, this kernel doesn't exist. But that's a geodesic statement. When you solve the wave equation, the statement is that you get exponentially decaying modes near the boundary. And what we showed in our paper was that for precisely these modes, the correlators of the fields on the boundary also decay exponentially. So while it looks naively like you have a divergence, now there's some exponential decay of the solutions near the boundary, this exponential decay is precisely compensated by the fact that the correlation functions of these modes are also exponentially small. So when you write down the transfer function, in the end it doesn't diverge. I can explain to you in more detail if you like, but I think this. Right. So. Fine. No, there's no. Fine. But this is an issue of defining some distribution, of writing down some generalized Fourier transform of it. So this is a formal mathematical question. In the end, what we are interested actually is always this. So if you see on this slide, which is I have something written in momentum space, which exists very clearly, and then you can talk about how to Fourier transform this. But that's, I think it's a mathematical question of how to define Fourier transforms of distributions. But the physical point that there is a one-to-one mapping between the boundary and the bulk, I think that remains true in the presence of a black hole also. Yes? No, we're not assuming the answer that we get. Right, so you could ask, how do we know that this is something that propagates in anti-de Sitter space and not in some other kind of flat space? I think the point is that if you do this perturbatively, you could say, how did EDS emerge, and how is it that some other space-time didn't emerge? And the point is that perturbatively, this kernel is fixed by demanding unitarity. Because on the boundary, you have some three-point functions. And when you convolute these operators with the kernel, you have to get local fields in the bulk. And if you don't choose the kernel correctly, you won't get locality at 1 by n order. So the conjecture is that locality basically fixes the form of this kernel to be that of the mode functions in anti-de Sitter space. In this case, so you could look at correlation functions of these fields either in the thermal theory, in which case the kernel would be fixed to being that in Schwarzschild ADS, or you could talk about these functions in just around the vacuum, correlators around the vacuum, in which case the kernel would be fixed to be that in anti-de Sitter space. So the conjecture is that locality and the fact that you have some OPE coefficients basically forces you to have some form of this kernel. It is ADS. What is not? Oh, right. So what I'm saying right now is that you take these operators, which are operators in the CFT, and these operators have certain correlation functions in this kind of pure state psi. I can make an integral transform of these operators. I get some other operators that look like they live in ADS Schwarzschild, okay? That have the same correlators as that of a perturbative field in ADS Schwarzschild. So the precise statement is that there is a recasting of the dynamics of the conformal field theory at finite temperature into the dynamics of a perturbative field living in ADS Schwarzschild. Okay. And now I'm going to say that this is the ADS-CFT duality. Now the statement is that the conformal field theory at finite temperature describes perturbative free fields living in ADS Schwarzschild. Okay. And the reason I'm saying that is because there's a recasting, which I can write down explicitly, of the dynamics of fields in the CFT. No, but this is, it's all a CFT calculation. The CFT is describing a field living in ADS Schwarzschild, as I'm going to describe in more detail. Let me describe how the interior of the black hole is constructed. But if this construction, the construction is clearly saying that the dynamics of the CFT can be recast as the dynamics of a field propagating in ADS Schwarzschild, not as a field propagating in a firewall. Yes, sir. Okay, so let me talk about what happens, how do you construct these operators in the interior of a black hole. So the first question is, what are the semi-classical expectations you have for what happens behind the horizon? So the semi-classical expectation is that a collapsing geometry, let's say you start with anti-de Sitter space and at some point you inject some matter from the boundary so that it collapses to form a black hole. The idea is that a collapsing geometry, this is just a semi-classical expectation, can be replaced by an eternal black hole geometry for a late enough observer, as long as you probe the geometry at late enough times. So the eternal black hole has these four regions, And this is the semi-classical expectation. What is the intuitive justification for the semi-classical expectation? I can tell you, it's basically the no-hair theorem, but I can give you an intuitive justification. The idea is, let's say you consider this eternal black hole geometry, but now I've drawn a Kruskal diagram instead of drawing a Penrose diagram. and you have an early observer. And this early observer tries to send a message to the late observer. You can see as this late observer L goes further and further, almost all the messages of this early observer fall into the black hole. And it becomes harder and harder for the early observer to send a message to the late observer, which is a statement that the late observer basically doesn't know much about what happened at early times, doesn't know much about the geometry of the initial collapsing star, but simply it looks to him like he's living in some eternal Schwarzschild black hole. So this is at least the semi-classical expectation. And now you could ask, well, okay, let's say you had an eternal Schwarzschild black hole, really an eternal Schwarzschild black hole, then what is, how would you perform this construction of the region behind the horizon? Now there's a well-known proposal by Maldacena, which is that the dual of an eternal black hole consists of two copies of a conformal field theory, one living on this boundary and the other living on this boundary. And these two copies are placed in a very specific kind of entangled state, which is called a thermofield double state. Okay, so they're placed in this kind of state, where you take an eigenstate E, there should be a sum, I forgot, there should be a sum over E, but eigenstate E on one CFT and the same eigenstate E in the other CFT multiplied with e to the minus beta e by 2 and summed over all eigenstates. So it's a very specific kind of entangled state, and this is believed to be dual to an eternal black hole. Okay, but the key point is that if this is correct, then imagine how you would construct these operators in this region too. You'd have to have operators that propagate from this side, from this CFT, into this region, and you'd need operators that propagate from here into this region. So to construct these operators, the semi-classical expectation at least, is that to construct operators behind the horizon, you cannot just analytically continue the operators that you have behind the horizon. You can't just take the operators you have outside the horizon and continue them past the horizon. You need some new kind of operators that look like they are coming from the other CFT. Okay? But we would like to work in a pure state, so the question you could ask is, what is the interpretation of these, you know, O tilde operators in a pure state? How much time do I have? 20 minutes? Okay. Let me try and describe this in some more detail. So the CFT in a, I'm going to try and describe to you, you know, what is the interpretation of these tilde operators. So CFT in a pure state, you know, the first question you could ask is, how is it that the CFT in a pure state looks like it is in a thermal state? And this always happens because you coarse-grain the system. You know, the reason the air in this room looks like it's approximately thermal is because I'm not keeping track of all the degrees of freedom in this. If I tried to keep track of all the molecules and everything, then I wouldn't look like, it wouldn't look to me like I was living in some approximately thermal state at some temperature. Okay? And so, for example, you could try and, you know, you could choose to measure, say, some occupancies, some linear combination of occupancies. You could have some detector that measures the occupancy energy in some mode, but it's not sensitive to a very specific mode. It measures some spread of these modes. But of course, you know, a number like this or some set of numbers like this don't completely fix the state of the theory. The state of the theory requires e to the n squared pieces of information, and some set of numbers like this don't fix the state of the theory. So it seems natural to divide the CFT Hilbert space into some degrees of freedom that you can easily access, which are your generalized free fields, and some occupation numbers that you can measure, and some other degrees of freedom that are much harder to access that are required to fix the state of the theory. So you could say that the state of the full Hilbert space of the CFT breaks up into some coarse-grained Hilbert space that you can measure and that looks thermal, and some fine-grained Hilbert space. And I'll return to this later at the end of the talk. And these fine-grained degrees of freedom, they act like a thermal bath for the coarse-grained degrees of freedom. So the CFT self-thermalizes, and it self-thermalizes because one part of the CFT acts as a thermal bath for the other part of the CFT. Okay? Now, if this is true, if this kind of direct product decomposition is true, then you can take any state in the CFT, and you could write it. This is saying nothing. You can write it in this way. But now you can take this matrix alpha, which is some rectangular matrix, and you can diagonalize this rectangular matrix. Okay? It's called a singular value decomposition. So you can diagonalize it so that it looks like this, okay? Which means you can take the state psi and write it in some very specific maximally entangled form. Okay? So that now these hatted guys are some orthonormal states in both the coarse and the fine state. And what your low energy observer really measures, as I said, is some coarse grain operator. You know, he can't really measure all the fine grain degrees of freedom of the CFT. And what he measures is some coarse grain operator. So, you know, he measures what you'd see after tracing out over the fine grain degrees of freedom. And this is something which is very natural from an effective field theory point of view. And this coarse grain operator can be written as some operator on the coarse grain Hilbert space. And now I'm going to define, okay, by definition, a mirror operator which acts on the fine-grained Hilbert space which is given by an antilinear map. You take these, it has to be antilinear for reasons that I can explain in more detail, which is given by an antilinear map and acts in a mirrored way on the fine-grained Hilbert space. Okay, so this is the definition of these tilde operators. Now, these tilde operators, we can show they behave in this pure state. You know, if you take some mixed correlator in this pure state of some these coarse-grained operators and some of these tilde operators, and if you assume furthermore that correlators of just O in this pure state are like thermal correlators, then you can show that mixed correlators of O and O tilde are like correlators of O and an analytically continued version of O, okay, with the definition that I showed in the previous slide. And this observation allows us to do computations with this proposal. Okay, so now using this construction of these tilde operators, you can construct local operators behind the horizon. And basically, the way you construct them is that, you know, you write down some mode functions, which are roughly the analytic continuations of the left-moving operators that come from the left side, and the right-moving operators that would have come from the right side. Okay, there's no right side, of course, because you're considering a single collapsing geometry, but you can think of what would have been, you know, the mode functions had there been an internal black hole, and you can write down these kinds of operators. These are, again, CFT operators. So this is a CFT operator. This O tilde is a CFT operator that I described, and so this is a CFT operator. Okay. And so you have some other CFT operator that looks like it's describing the physics inside a black hole. Okay. So now you have these operators that look like they're describing, you know, propagators both outside and inside the horizon, and you can compute correlation functions, and these correlation functions look like they're completely regular as you cross the horizon. Okay. So the statement is that you can take the dynamics of the conformal field theory and you can recast the dynamics into the dynamics of perturbative fields propagating in a Schwarzschild ADS spacetime, but in a regular Schwarzschild ADS spacetime, which doesn't see any firewalls. Okay? And so, you know, since this is the case, it's very natural to say that the dual of some CFT in a thermal state or in a pure state, which is very close to being thermal, is an ADS Schwarzschild spacetime and not a firewall. But now you could ask, how do you reconcile this with the claims about the information paradox that I mentioned earlier? So let me spend some time describing how you do this. Okay. So as I said, we believe that it should be possible to correct this construction order by order and one by n, but we don't know what happens non-perturbatively. Okay, it may clearly not be possible to interpret non-perturbative physics in the CFT in terms of some local bulk physics. And the claim I'm going to try and make is that these exponentially small non-perturbative corrections, which are of order e to the minus s, very small corrections, are enough to restore unitarity to Hawking radiation and are enough to also resolve the information paradox. So exponentially suppressed corrections are enough to do this. Okay. Now, why do you expect these exponentially suppressed corrections, and what can you say about them? So just from a path integral point of view, if you try and formulate gravity via path integral, you see that when you talk about a semi-classical space-time, a semi-classical spacetime is a saddle point of this path integral. And anything that you, and whenever you talk about computing quantum gravity correlators, you're talking about doing an asymptotic expansion about the saddle point. Clearly, if you'd like to speak of non-perturbative effects, you don't have a notion of a semi-classical spacetime. So at order e to the minus s, you don't expect that there should be some notion of locality. So if you violate locality even very badly, but at order e to the minus s, that is okay, at least you'd expect it to be okay from the path integral perspective. Now there's, you know, sometimes there's some criticism of this based on numbers. So there's some recent papers that say, well, how can this be because the black hole is so big? But the point is these corrections are very small. Okay, so the entropy of a, you know, there was a recent paper that said this is impossible because in a solar mass black hole is 10 to the 77 times the Planck length. And that's okay, but the entropy of a solar mass black hole is also 10 to the 77. And so these exponentially suppressed corrections are e to the minus 10 to the 77. So, you know, even though their corrections are spread out in some sense over a very large distance scale, they're tremendously small corrections. And you expect that such corrections would exist in the world. Okay. So let me start by just describing how these corrections can fix Hawking radiation, can fix this information paradox. So the first question you could ask is, you know, can it be that the exact Hawking matrix that you get is the original Hawking matrix, Hawking density matrix, plus e to the minus s into some correction matrix? And you have no control over this correction matrix, okay? You don't, all bets are off in this correction matrix. This correction matrix can involve correlators between the first Hawking quanta and the last Hawking quanta, and between all the Hawking quanta and middle. The only condition you have is that it's a very small matrix. These are numerically suppressed by e to the minus s, but other than that, you can't say that they're block diagonal or, you know, or anything of that sort. So there are no bets on the form of this correction matrix. Okay, so we can show this is possible. In our paper, we had various checks to show this is possible. Let me just give you a very simple toy model to convince you, just an example of how this is possible. Okay, so consider some system of n spin half spins, and this system has 2^n states. I'm just giving you an example, and you can look at the paper to see why, in general, we believe this is possible. And you can write these 2^n states as binary numbers. So, you know, the state where all the spins are up, you write as 0, but the last one is down, you write as 1, and this is 2 and 3, and so on. So, you can write these as binary numbers. Now, you can consider some generic pure state in the spin chain model, which is some arbitrary sum of the previous states I described, where I choose these coefficients once and for all to be either 1 or minus 1. You could choose them to be complex numbers if you like, but just for simplicity, I'm going to choose them to be 1 or minus 1. And then you can consider breaking off these spins one by one and looking at the density matrix of the spins that you break off. So it's a rather simple computation. If you look, for example, at the density matrix of the first spin, you see that this density matrix is basically the identity. So this is the equivalent of the density matrix being thermal. And in fact, if you look at k spins, as long as k is smaller than n by 2, the density matrix will look exactly like the identity up to exponentially small corrections. But once you start looking at more than n by 2 spins, then these exponentially small corrections become important. Okay? So this is an example of a situation where you have some density matrix which is corrected by exponentially small terms so that the full density matrix is pure, even though it looks like, you know, this couldn't happen. But the reason this happens is because, you know, the size of the density matrix is 2^n × 2^n. So even if its elements are very small, it's possible to add this to some matrix that looks thermal and get a pure density matrix. And this is an example of that kind. And we have more general examples in our paper. Okay, now you could ask, well, can you resolve the strong subadditivity paradox using this? Let me remind you, since I've spoken about many things, that there are these three systems, A, B, and C, and the system B looks like it's entangled with C, and the system B looks like it's entangled with A. So what does our construction say about this? So our construction leads us to expect that there are exponentially small commutators between operators outside and inside the black hole. And that's because, you know, we constructed these operators inside the black hole, but that was after some coarse training prescription. And we know that, you know, this coarse training prescription can't be exact. There have to be some exponential differences between these coarse train operators that we measure and the true operators. So we expect that there should be exponentially small corrections between operators that you measure here and these operators inside. So that is, in some sense, a natural realization of what is called black hole complementarity, which is the statement that the operators outside the black hole and the operators inside the black hole are not independent. And they have small commutators, which are suppressed by e^-s, but they're nevertheless non-zero. Okay? And so in some sense, the interior is a scrambled version of part of the exterior. Now, our perspective on black hole complementarity is slightly different from the earlier perspective, which said that no single observer can measure both the interior and the exterior. In fact, you can have a super observer who lives in the conformal field theory who can measure, you know, all these correlators, who can measure all correlators. And the statement is not that he can't measure the interior and the exterior, but rather that if he starts measuring CFT correlators to exponential accuracy, then there is no interpretation of those correlators in terms of some local spacetime. Okay, so there are super observers clearly in the CFT who can measure whatever correlators they like, but exponentially accurate correlators can't be interpreted in terms of a semi-classical spacetime, which is or local spacetime, which is not surprising. Okay, and I wanted to say that, you know, complementarity is not a new proposal, and the original motivation for complementarity went through what was called the Nice-Lice argument. And so there are many reasons to believe complementarity. The Nice-Lice argument said, well, consider some collapsing matter, and here's a horizon, and here's some Nice-Lice, which nowhere goes through the singularity, oops, and where, you know, the curvatures are small always. This Nice-Lice can capture more than half of the Hawking radiation that's coming out of the black hole, but it also intersects the old matter, and so it must be that somehow the radiation that's coming here is duplicating the information that's here. And what we're saying is that that's possible with exponentially small commutators. Okay, let me take you to some recent developments in this. As I said, there's some objections to this proposal. These objections were made by AMPSS in their recent paper this year. And let me just try and explain their objections and then describe what our answer to the objections is. So just to explain the objections, I'm going to go back to this toy model of spin chains. And as I said, you can model these Hawking quanta that are going out in terms of spins that are breaking off from the spin chain. I want to say that in the end, I'm going to say this is a little misleading, but you can model it in this way. And then you can ask, well, in the spin chain, can you also model the quanta that are falling into the black hole? Can you model the partners of these particles that fall into the black hole? And you can. In fact, you can go through our construction to do so. And the idea is basically as follows. You know, let's say you coarse train the system. You say, well, I can measure only the first spin, and all the other n minus 1 spins are fine-grained degrees of freedom. And so you have some pure state. By definition, it can be written as, you know, saying the first state is in spin up, and everything else is the other n minus 1 spins are in some state, which I call phi plus, and plus some linear combination of the first state being spin down and the other n minus 1 spins being in some state of this kind. And the spin 1 operator that you measure is this operator. And you can define this operator going by a construction so that it's precisely anti-correlated with the operator for the first spin, and it commutes with the operator for the first spin. So in the spin chain model itself, you can construct the analog of not only the particle falling out, but also the particles falling in. The problem is, you can keep doing this, but the problem is that once you've crossed more than n by 2 spins, then the fine-grained space that you have left behind becomes smaller in dimension than the coarse grain space you have outside. And so it looks like you can no longer define these tilde operators. Okay? Or if you could try and define these tilde operators, but then they would have large commutators with these coarse grain operators. Okay? So the claim is that it's not possible to have this coarse fine distinction once more than half the black hole has evaporated. Okay, then in some sense, it looks like all the degrees of freedom are outside, and so all of them are naively accessible to some coarse grain observer. And so the space that remains is smaller in dimension than the coarse grain space that's outside. And if that's the case, then you can't define these tilde operators. Okay? So let me just try and tell you abstractly what the problem is. What is not a violation? So this is an order one violation of locality. That's the complaint against black hole complementarity, if this is true. Let me just complete since I'm coming. I can address this. So the abstract problem is that, you know, you need some Hilbert space, and you have some subspace in this, which I call H in, and you have some basis of operators for this Hilbert space, and there's some other basis of operators for this subspace, so that these two operators almost commute. Okay? So you have some big space, in that you have some subspace, and you scramble the basis in that subspace so that it commutes almost exactly with the original basis up to the dimension of the full Hilbert space. And moreover, these on and these on tilde are perfectly correlated up to exponential corrections. Okay, so this is the kind of setup that you need. And as I mentioned, and I can describe in more detail, I'm running out of time, in the spin chain model, it looks like it's very hard to do this. In the spin chain model, if you take the basis of the original Hilbert space, these ons to be just the different spin operators for the different spins, it looks like it isn't possible to find this kind of construction, which has small commutators. And that's the criticism that AMPSS made of our construction. But this is something that's not generic, and I'm going to give you an example now of a system, you know, it's of a system which is more physically motivated, where you do have this coarse fine splitting. So imagine a system, some atom maybe, or some other system, which has these energy levels, and these energy levels are very closely spaced. Okay? Here I have two scales. There's some widely spaced energy levels and some closely spaced energy levels. But what I really need is this fine spacing in these energy levels. And let's say the system is coupled to some photons, okay, it's coupled to some electric field. And so decays of the system decays from this energy level to this energy level, and it emits a photon as it decays. Okay? Now this, if you look at the photon field outside, you can quantize it. Okay, you can quantize it in terms of these frequencies and some other very closely spaced frequencies. Okay, so there are different kinds of frequencies that appear, but some of these frequencies are very close to each other, and some of them are not so close to each other. But if you have an observer who has limited resolving power, then what this observer will see is some effective coarse grain field. Okay, he can't really resolve the difference between these two frequencies. So what he sees is the sum of these creation and annihilation operators. And if you consider, in fact, some microcanonical configuration of photons with some fixed energy, you can show that this observer with limited resolving power cannot determine the state of the initial field, because, in fact, half the number of degrees of freedom are stored in excitations of these linearly independent oscillators. So this is an example of a system. Okay, it's a system with some particular dynamics where I told you that the observables were of a particular kind. But these observables, in some sense, these A observables do form a complete set of observables. But nevertheless, you can define some other observables which commute with these guys to an excellent accuracy. Okay? Now you could ask, is this independent? Is this relevant to the conformal field theory? But in fact, the black hole does have these closely spaced frequencies. And the energy levels of a black hole, even in global ADS, are spaced with e to the minus s. So even though global ADS is some compact spacetime, the dual of the global ADS is the CFT that lives on S3, in spite of that, the energy levels of the black hole state are exponentially spaced. You know, they're not spaced, their spacing is not order one, it's exponentially spaced. And moreover, it looks like the black hole does radiate into all of these frequencies, because if you solve the Klein-Gordon equation in the black hole background, the spectrum of the Klein-Gordon equation is not discrete as it is in empty ADS, but rather it's continuous. And so it does look like, if you look at the natural observables that live in global ADS, they do have this kind of affine structure, which lives in the fact that there is extremely closely spaced frequencies that you can radiate into. Okay, so to summarize, the resolution is that even though, in some sense, if you have some black hole that has evaporated, so that a lot of the black hole has evaporated, and in some sense the information is outside, if you have this kind of fine structure in the information, then the coarse-grained Hilbert space is not the same as the Hilbert space that is, quote-unquote, outside the black hole. Okay? And in fact, you can use the fine structure of the emitted radiation to reconstruct the interior of the black hole. Okay? And if this is really how things work in the CFT, and as I said, it's plausible that this is how things work because of the structure of energy levels, then this leads to commutators that are exponentially suppressed and not order one, and this is an acceptable violation of locality. Okay, let me just summarize. I'm done, but let me just summarize. So the firewall proposal suggests that quantum effects can violently alter the structure of the space-time, okay, which is a very bad violation of our usual notions of effective field theory. So we constructed local operators inside and outside a black hole. We have a proposal for constructing integral transforms of these operators both outside and inside the black hole, a specific proposal, and you can do computations with these proposals. And in this computation, you find that the horizon is completely regular. It doesn't have any such phenomena. But our construction also leads us to expect that there should be these non-local, you know, corrections, completely non-local corrections to this local dynamics that are exponentially suppressed in the entropy of the black hole. Now, we don't have any control over these non-local corrections, but the last point I want to make is that these corrections are sufficient in principle. Of course, we haven't computed these e to the minus s corrections. That's something that's extremely hard. But these corrections are sufficient in principle, as I tried to explain in the last part of my talk, to resolve the information paradox. But it requires, you know, some understanding of the CFT Hilbert space, and we need to understand this distinction between coarse and fine degrees of freedom a little better and argue that it is indeed true to find these, you know, coarse and fine degrees of freedom in the CFT Hilbert space. And if this is true, then, as I said, these corrections would in principle be sufficient to resolve the information paradox without any need for firewalls. Okay, so I'll stop there.
So if they are sufficient, and I mean, there's many purported resolutions to this problem, so I'd have to think about how much I'd buy this. But it depends on ADS CFT, so would you say that asymptotically flat black holes or cosmological black holes, or there's no hope for resolution? I mean,
no,
how is this going to work?
You could consider small black holes in ADS, which behave probably very similarly to flat space black holes. You could probably consider small black holes in anti-de Sitter space, which behave similarly to flat space black holes. So it's true that the construction I described here was done in detail for big black holes in ADS, but it shouldn't be so hard to extend it to small black holes in ADS, which behave extremely similarly to flat space black holes. So there isn't an obstruction in using ADS CFT even for small black holes. And then there are these other even better examples that you have of these things called plasma balls in ADS. So these are balls, you know, these are solutions which are in flat space, they're not in global ADS, but they're localized in one of the transverse directions. So these are solutions that were constructed numerically by Wiseman and Minvalla and others, and these plasma balls, they really decay almost exactly the way as flat space black holes do, because there's an entire transverse direction. So in some sense, they're big in that their horizon radius is large compared to the ADS radius, but they're small in the transverse directions, and they just, you know, they decay exactly the way flat space black holes do. They're like a plasma ball or some quark gluon plasma, living in the CFT, and it just decays by the emission of blue balls.
Can I just ask a question about your previous slide?
Yes.
So your proposal there.
What do you want to see? This one?
Yeah, the last bullet. Yeah, that commutator.
Yes. Yes.
So if I just don't carefully pick my phi out, your
yes.
claim is that it's e to the minus s.
Yes.
But if I do choose it very carefully, then it should be 1. Is that correct?
Well,
is there no outside operator whose commutator is 1?
Well, no. There are some outside operators which you can construct. You know, it's like this. It's this kind of example. Now, you know, there is some linear combination. So these are like the inside operators. Okay. So you have some field that's of this kind that's these very closely spaced frequencies. Now you can construct some extremely complicated combination of these fields, you could Fourier transform it with exactly this frequency and subtract off the Fourier transform with a slightly different frequency. And then you'd get some commutator that's order one. So, you know, there are some extraordinarily precise operators which require exponentially precise things which have order one commutators. Yes.
Any other question?
There's a question here, I think.
There is a question here?
Yeah, I think there's a question here.
Now, what about the degrees of freedom, say, in the matter of collapsing to form the black hole?
Yes.
You know, are they, say a little more about how they would get, say, into the correlations of the Hawking radiation? Or would they?
So, you know, we don't have any, what we're saying is that they would get in via these exponentially suppressed corrections. Now, you could ask for a detailed mechanism of how these exponentially suppressed corrections are generated. We don't have such a detailed mechanism. This would require non-perturbative computations in the CFT. But what we're saying is that it's natural to expect these corrections, and these corrections in principle, you know, allow the information to leak out. E to the minus s corrections, but over e to the s states, in principle, allow the corrections to leak out. We don't have any detailed mechanism for how exactly these corrections leak out, because that's a very hard computation. But it's more conservative to expect that such corrections exist, and if they're sufficient in principle, it's more conservative to believe that they will in principle allow the information to leak out than to believe that our notions of effective field theory get violated radically.
Okay, so let's thank again our speaker.